Okay, this is Kira Viewick, and it is May 28, 2004 in San Antonio, Texas at the Army Nurse Corps Association Convention, and I'm with Hannah Moynihan Nguyen. So we'll just start with where you grew up, where you're born and raised.
Okay, I was born and raised in Maine, in Elliott, Maine, which I was born there and raised there and went to school in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which just happens to be 2 miles across the river. But you have to be a New Englander to appreciate the fact that how close the states are. And I'm the oldest of five children. And I went to parochial schools. When I graduated from high school, it became pretty evident that my family was not well off. And back then, I'm talking about, what am I talking about, in the 50s, early 50s, it was girls could be school teachers. They could be nurses, or they could go to work for the telephone company or something like that. That's essentially what was presented to us. And I knew I didn't want to be working the telephone company, and I didn't want to be a school teacher, so I opted for nursing. And we found in Manchester, New Hampshire, a nursing school run by the same nuns that had gone through grade school, with where for $200 admission, which my parents could get together, that's where I went. And we worked, it was a 3-year nursing program, and we started working as nurses after the first 6 months. And we had no summer vacations, We were, we weren't slaves, but we were used. But that, but everybody who went into the nursing then, you know, was used that way. They had minimum registered nurses in BUCU student nurses, and that's, you know, and one of my classmates was from Massachusetts, and she was the oldest of three in her family. Her family had a little more money than we did, but we talked about what we were going to do when we got out of school. Now, one of the big options back there was to go to Boston. That was the big thing. Go to Boston and get a job in Boston. But we both decided we needed to get farther away than Boston. And one day, about our third year, Joanne said, do you know, we could go in the Army. I had absolutely no knowledge of the Army, nurses in the Army, at all. And I went home and I started talking to talking about it to my parents, and it turned out that they had a very good friend who was an Army nurse in the Second World War. And I don't know how they knew her, but she'd been a nurse in the Army. Somehow they knew her. Anyway, so when Joanne and I decided that we were going to pursue this, actually she pursued it, and I was right on her tail. She found out where we had to go in Boston to have a physical and everything, and we graduated in June. And she went to work. Now, okay, she's graduated from 3-year nursing school, and she went to work in a hospital in Massachusetts where she was pouring ether in the operating room for in the obstetrics department of this hospital. She didn't have 10 seconds instruction in pouring ether. But anyway, that's sort of what, you know, the way it was. Anyway, and I also got stuck in an obstetrics job because I don't know why, new students, but I hated it. I just hated it. I had experiences of in being in the labor room and sending some woman in to the delivery room, and her doctor came and said she had about 4 hours more to go. It was awful. I hated it. But in the meantime, we were working on her parents about going in the Army. And I went, and I did go to my parents, and I said, we're going to do this. And I remember my parents like, oh my God, you're going to be traveling. What are you going to be with all this awful? And I think it's the first time I ever said the word whore to my mother. I said, do you think I couldn't live right here under your roof and be a whore? If I go in the Army, I'm going to be a whore? And I go, you know, by this time she had her fingers in her ear. And then I brought up the fact that they knew. I wish I could remember it. I said, what about your friend? She was a good. So anyway, they didn't have a leg to stand on by then. So Joan and I, we met and we went to Boston. And the one thing I remember way back then that we didn't have to have a vaginal exam, we had to have a rectal exam. I'm 21 years old, the most sheltered 21-year-old you can ever imagine. And I remember this doctor saying to me, "Well, you're a nurse. This shouldn't be hard for you." Thinking, "You jerk! How can you think just because?" Anyway, you want all my recollections. So anyway, Joanne and I, we signed all the papers and we got accepted, and we're flying out of Boston to Fort Sam, Houston. Mm-hmm. My birthday is the 9th of May. We left like about the 7th or 8th because I had my 22nd birthday at Fort Sam, Houston. Mm-hmm. And we were here and we were so loose. I mean, we were just let loose. We were like prisoners let loose someplace. Mm-hmm. First, we were given this $300 clothing allowance, which was to buy uniforms. So we bought $100 worth of uniforms and $200 worth of something else. And also, this is 1955, and she and I were roomed together, and we had a roommate who was a black girl from the South, okay? Mm-hmm. There were probably 6 black girls in our class, in our Fort Sam Houston class. Mm-hmm. And the girl that we shared a bath with was very shy, very quiet, and Joanne and I decided that she should go out. You know, we were going downtown. We had no money. You know, we had enough for the bus. So we invited her. We kept asking her and asking her and asking her. And finally she agreed, and we came down, and we said to her, "We have no money. We're just walking around. And then we decided to go and have something to eat. Now, here's the dummy from Maine and dummy from Massachusetts who did not see the sign in the window. Because in 1955, there were signs in the windows, mm-hmm. No blacks. And this girl, as we got, we stood there and they said, "No, we're not serving lunch." And we said, "That's all. Well, you know, it's noon. What are all these people doing here?" Mm-hmm. And the black girl, you know, I just don't remember her name. I hope she doesn't remember the incident. But she said, "I'm going back. It's okay, I'm going back." And then suddenly, we realized what the hell was going on. We were so, so stupid. We had no idea. But in 1955, it was still going on. It was still segregated. Mm-hmm. And after that, we were very careful. You know, we were here for 6 weeks training, for our 6 weeks training. And we got our uniforms and, you know, did all the things we had to do. And in the meantime, we had one trip to Laredo. We went down to Mexico. Which was like, for us, it was like coming out of a genie box. I mean, you know, we didn't even hardly know. Okay, and then came, at the end of 6 weeks, our assignments. Mm-hmm. And we were such worldly women that we had two options. We could just get an assignment, or we could go someplace together. Guess mm-hmm. what? We decided we would go someplace together. So we did. And Joanne and I went to El Paso, to William Beaumont, mm-hmm. and together. And we got there, and the chief nurse was also a bigot, a humongous bigot. Mm-hmm. We sat down in front of her, and she said, "Oh, I see 2 Catholic girls." You know, I'm saying, you know, so what? You know, what does that have to do with the price of tea in China, and what kind of a job we're going to get? Uh-huh. You know, I'm going to be an acolyte or something. What, you know, anyway, I remember this woman's name, but I would never say it. Anyway. So she wanted to know our experience, and they needed someone in obstetrics. Well, we both had worked in obstetrics. Mm-hmm. I told you my friend had already been pouring it. I said, "Oh, God, no, Joe." Joan said, "Oh, yes, I'll take that job." And then she said, "Then we have a place in pediatrics." Well, you know, I have to tell you, I really went in the Army because I had been taking care of 4 brothers and sisters my whole bloody life, but I didn't want to go to obstetrics. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was the beginning of my pediatric career in the Army, and I stayed in that until my assignments in Korea and Vietnam, uh-huh. where suddenly they didn't need pediatrics, they needed whatever. Uh-huh. Okay, and that was that. Okay, and then where are we? You want me to keep talking about my experiences?
Sure.
Okay. Now, I had said I wanted to come into the Army to travel, uh-huh. and so I kept going to the personnel office saying, "I want to go to Europe. Mm-hmm. I'm only here for 2 years, and I want to go to Europe." And they kept saying, "Lieutenant, don't come back again. You know, we got your name on the list. I said, "Well, I'm getting out of the Army at the end of 2 years, because if I don't go to Europe." Uh-huh. And then it was coming closer and closer to the 2 years that I had, you know, that I had promised. In the meantime, my friend Joanne had met a guy at Fort Bliss. She was down for the artillery school. They'd fallen madly in love, and she went and got married on me. Uh-huh. She went and got married on me, and there I am, all by myself. And I'll tell you another funny thing. I don't care who hears this. Oh, I missed him. I missed them so much. And Tony was a marvelous, marvelous guy. When they came back from their honeymoon, uh-huh. I went to their quarters, and the three of us slept in the bed together. Now, Tony was in the middle because they were married, because we were talking and talking and talking and talking, and finally Tony said, "We have to go to bed." And we all went to bed, and the three of us slept together, slept together in a bed that night. And I became, you know, I became such a part of them. And their oldest daughter is my godchild, who also became in the Army, and she was an MSC, I mean, anyway, and their son is a graduate of West Point. I mean, anyway, huh. Goes on from there. Anyway, so when she left me, I was almost afraid to, you know, I thought maybe I better go back to LA. I better go back and go to Boston. Mm-hmm. But then just before the 2 years was up, I got a call from the sergeant and the personnel who said, "Lieutenant, you come down here, you re-up, and you're on your way to Germany." Ta-da! Uh-huh. So the first thing I did really on my own, I re-upped. Mm-hmm. And I guess, I can't remember now if you have to re-up for 4 years. I think at that time you had to re-up for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so I left there, I went, came home for a visit, and I went to Heidelberg, Germany, mm-hmm. where I spent almost 3 years, 2.5, 3 years. It was magnificent. It was like heaven. It was like we were like tourists. We worked 5 days a week. Uh-huh. We're busy, we worked 5 days a week. I worked in pediatrics. And we had every weekend off, and then we'd have vacations, we'd have long weekends. I traveled all over Europe. I had two German nurses who worked with me who were marvelous, marvelous friends of mine until the day they died. And I bought a Fiat station wagon, a 1952 Fiat station wagon, which you would never ever see in your whole life, which had Mach-Nix sticks, which were Mach-Nix in Germany means who cares, and they were our signals. It was a little thing. The Mach-Nix stick would come up out here. That meant you're making a left turn, making a right turn. It had a starter, was just, you know, just pull this little button and it started. I also made friends with a civilian gal who came over whose husband was going to the University of Heidelberg Medical School. He didn't get into an American medical school uh-huh. back in the States then. That was, okay, what am I saying? This is late 50s. And we became very good friends. In fact, she sort of lied to get her civilian job because she was pregnant when she got the job. And in order to have your baby in the military hospital, you had to have been there so long, certain period of time. Uh-huh. She made it. In fact, I drove her in my little Fiat from her house to go and have her baby. And her son is my godchild, too. Uh-huh. Anyway, okay, Germany. And then, okay, after Germany, which is a marvelous experience. I worked in pediatrics. I ran a pediatrics ward. And at that time, because there were a lot of military people over there, so we had a lot of, we're making babies, having babies by the gazillion, and we had a lot of kids to take care of. Mm-hmm. And then it was time to come home. Then I had to make a decision. Was I going to get out of the Army mm-hmm. or was I not? Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that I had no reason to get out. Back in those days, nurses, it was hard for nurses to travel like they do now. Nurses mm-hmm. travel all over. They can work for a week here and a week there. And back then, if you said you had had 4 jobs in the last 2 years, they'd look at you like, mm-hmm. there's something wrong with you. Uh-huh. Why did you leave? And if you said, well, because I got bored, you didn't get bored, they threw you out. Mm-hmm. The Army, who cares? I could travel all over, and the Army would tell me when I would leave, mm-hmm. and I would have the same kind of job, and I was getting more money, I was getting raises because I was getting promoted uh-huh. all along the way. Uh-huh. So anyway, I decided to stay, and that's when I went regular Army. I think I went regular Army because they came back, and I came to Walter Reed. Mm-hmm. I came to Walter Reed. And from Walter Reed, I came back down here to a course. After you decide to go regular Army, they send you to a career course. Mm-hmm. that tells you, then you have to know a little more about the Army. Mm-hmm. How many units are in a stuff and all that, you get all that Army stuff. And from there, I went to Korea. Mm-hmm. The war was over. The war was over. But I was in a regular MASH hospital, you know. Mm-hmm. No, at an evac hospital. And it was still full of GIs because we had troops, mm-hmm. gazillion troops still over there. We also were taking care of a lot of civilians, partly because the doctors wanted to take care of the civilians because they had such things as tuberculosis, which we never, mm-hmm. nobody saw tuberculosis in the United States, and a lot of other different diseases. So, and when I got there, of course they had no pediatrics, so I worked in orthopedics, mm-hmm. which turned out to be almost pediatrics because we had three wards. We had an intermediate, we had an acute, really acute, but these kids had to stay in the hospital until they could go back to work. So if they had a cast on, they couldn't go back to work. So they were there for months and months and months and months. They were, you know, all sorts of, okay, I'm going to tell you one funny story. One funny story from Korea. A young man, very naive young man, had a broken femur, I think, which means he was in the hospital for ages and ages and ages and ages. And of course, he was in the unit where the people could visit. And of course, these GIs could take not leaves, but they could go out at night and they go down to the Ville and they had girlfriends and the girlfriends would visit them and everything. And this poor little guy's over in the corner and he'd been there for weeks and weeks and weeks, and suddenly one day he discovers that he has body lice. His body lice, his cramps. How could he get them? He hasn't been out of his bloody bed for that long. Anyway. He was sick about it. He was absolutely sick. But they had been girls in there. It was almost like a bordello in that, you know, in the unit that he was in. It was so very. I remember how upset he was. We tried to explain to him it was okay. It wasn't from him. It was from the mattress. It was from the guys around him or something. Mm-hmm. Then I have to tell you one other funny story. Anyway, some of this will be okay. When I very first got there, I told you I'd been in pediatrics mm-hmm. for all these years, and I was a head nurse, and I had two young men who were second lieutenants had been there for a while, and this big GI came and he was on crutches and he had a cast on his leg, and he said, "Okay, you've been doing you've been doing interviews with nurses, so you understand, you know, an SOP is." Standard operating procedure. Okay, so there were certain drugs. Yeah, you could give them aspirin. You could give them cough syrup. You could give them all this. Okay, so this guy comes to the nurse's station, and in Korea was Quonset huts too. We're mm-hmm. in Quonset, so we're in this little room, and he comes and he said, "Hey, ma'am," he said, "I have a little problem here." He said, "I got this drip," and I turned around. I said, "No problem." And the two young men, I didn't realize it. I turned around, I opened the medicine cabinet, and I pulled out a little thing of neosinephrine nose drops. Mm-hmm. And I handed them to him. And the two guys are standing behind me. And he looked at me and he said, "Hey, ma'am, this is a different kind of drip." And I knew exactly. I said, "Okay, go back." Because the other standard operation procedure was to do a test and then give them penicillin. So these two young nurses just looked at me, and I tried not to be too embarrassed, and I said to them, "Okay, you know, get a smear, and I will give him his penicillin." So they did it, and I went back, and I took the needle, and he went, and he said, "Hey, ma'am, that really hurts." I said, "So does the disease that I'm curing." Okay, now, the real funny part of this story is we were living in a little world, you know, everyone knew everything that went on in this uh-huh. little complex, you know, we all lived together. So an hour or so later, I went to lunch. I walked into the mess hall, and I was greeted with, "Hey, we hear you have the new cure for VD, and it's called neosinephrine nose drop. Ho, 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 ho." Everyone in the hospital had heard the story. So I was known for the rest of the year as the lady with the cure for VD, and it was neosinephrine nose drop. Anyway, okay, so I left Vietnam. Where did I come from Vietnam? Oh, I went to Fitzsimmons. I left Korea.
How long were you in Korea?
1 year.
Okay.
Now, Betty Angela, that's where we met. My husband, actually, we met there too. He was married and had a big family, that's where he was one of the chiefs of orthopedics.
Uh-huh.
So he was one of the guys who was ripping me about curing BD. Okay.
So you met him in Korea?
In Korea. I met him in Korea in 1963. Uh-huh. Okay. Then I came back to Fitzsimmons. I went to Fitzsimmons, and Betty came to Fitzsimmons too, and then we both went to the University of Omaha, Nebraska, which had a degree completion program there, specific for the military.
Mm-hmm.
If you could finish your baccalaureate degree in 6 months, because the Army was really gung-ho then to have all their officers have undergraduate degrees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and nurses primarily were the biggest bandits, because we didn't, we came from a 3-year program.
Uh-huh.
And they had a few other different officers who'd come up. So Betty and I and a few other people then spent 6 months in Omaha, Nebraska,
mm-hmm.
finishing our baccalaureate degree.
Mm-hmm. And that was in 63?
And that was in because I was at Fitzsimmons from 64, 65.
Okay.
This was maybe 60. This was 67. This was 67.
Okay.
Because then I was there. Then 68, I went from Omaha to Vietnam.
Okay.
And I asked to go to Vietnam. I'll tell you why, because I was very practical. All my stuff was in storage, and I thought, I'm gonna get assigned there. I'm in regular Army. They're gonna send me. I'm gonna go to Vietnam very soon.
Mm-hmm.
But if I volunteer to go now, then I don't get settled someplace and then have to unsettle. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. And what was the difference between regular Army and
reserves? Regular Army, you were committed, to 20 years. I mean, now, interestingly enough. Truly, I have a lot of friends who are in the reserves, who were in the Army Reserves, who retired and then upon retirement got promotion. So they made as much money as I did.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure. Now, there are those who can explain it to you much better. But I just did it. I told you, when I came back from Germany, it was just kind of the thing to do. Then I didn't have to worry about re-upping every so many years.
Uh-huh.
But I knew I was going to stay in the Army
uh-huh.
until something happened.
So this was your career by this
time? Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Did you think of it in those terms?
I really did. You know, I thought, I met a lot of guys along the way, and I had really thoughts about, but then when I did the pros and the cons of somehow, the cons of marrying somebody, outweighed the pros of marrying
mm-hmm.
somebody.
Uh-huh.
Really? No, I mean, you uh-huh. know, there were a number of times where I met really, really nice guys, and it came to be like, what am I giving up for this?
Uh-huh.
And nothing was as important as what I was doing at the time. You know,
uh-huh.
I didn't meet anyone that, that was that important.
Uh-huh. Would you have had to,
at that
time, married
no,
at
no,
the
no.
Army?
Nope, not at that
okay.
time. At that time, you couldn't.
So
at that
if you
time,
got
you
married,
couldn't.
You would have to
I would have had to get out. And of course now you're talking to people like who have families and
uh-huh.
yeah, it's an entirely different world.
Uh-huh.
Different world. Back then no, I would have had to get out.
Uh-huh.
And I used to say like, God, I haven't seen everything I want to see.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so when I came back there I was at Fitzsimmons and Pete's and then now we're in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're in Vietnam.
And you just volunteered because of
I volunteered just because it was convenient for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some of my friends who would say, but it's the truth. It was convenient for me. I knew I was going to go.
Uh-huh.
And why should I unpack all my stuff and get all settled someplace
uh-huh.
For 6 months? Because that was happening to people.
Uh-huh.
That was happening. So anyway, I said, I may as well go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you didn't record all that. That's where I was mouthing off to a while ago. But so I got over there. And I was there in the room with the chief nurse and a bunch of second lieutenants, eager. I was a major at the time. And they just, they knew, you know, all the places where, you know, mm-hmm. by the time they got through, I knew all the places where all the war was going on. And I saw this little place down here. I didn't really know much about what's going on. I had some friends who were over there, you know, but not that many. That was before the Tet. I didn't know too many people who had been over there, but, you know, I knew the Vung Tau was kind of, you know, down there in the Riviera section. Anyway, so the chief nurse is going on and on about where they need people, and these kids are just going bananas. And then she said, "But now, Major, you know, I need a senior officer in Vung Tau." I said, "Colonel, that's absolutely fine with me." And let's see, I got on a helicopter and went down and became the assistant chief. No, I didn't. Connie Slowitzky. Have you met mm-hmm. Connie? You know Connie? Okay. Connie was the assistant chief nurse there.
Uh-huh.
And I became a supervisor, you know, under Connie. Uh-huh. There was a chief nurse, Colonel Decker, and then Connie, and then I, you know, was the supervisor.
Okay.
Medical supervisor.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very quiet, you know, we wore fatigues. We wore fatigues and boots and all that stuff. And we, you know, we ran a hospital. It was Quonset Huts, and mm-hmm. we ran the hospital, just like a regular hospital. And we had one medical ward with air-conditioned because we had a lot of malarias. I told you that. We had a lot of malarias. That's where they were in medical things. And other things were, we were doing hernias and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And DPC, which is a delayed primary closure. That means somebody's got a little injury.
Uh-huh.
They used to leave the wound open and bring them to the hospital and leave it open for a while before they close. And
that is that because it would get infected?
Yeah, to keep it from getting infected on the field, you know, because they were treated on the field. Anyway, and we lived in a Villa Dubois. And I remember immediately writing to my family saying, "I'm in Vung Tau, which is an old French, which is the French Riviera of the old Vietnam."
Mm-hmm.
The guy who got thrown out. Anyway, and we're living in a villa, and it's called Villa Dubois. You know, this is what I wrote home. And it didn't take more than a day or so before people were talking about Dubois. And I said, "Dubois? No. It's a Colonel Dubois who was one of the, was an army guy who built this place." Well, you know, part of the reason that I thought it was an old villa because it was falling down. But it had been Vietnamese made, so it looked like it was falling down. So then I had to retract all this and tell my parents I was living in Villa Dubois, and Colonel Dubois was the CO of the unit.
Not quite as romantic.
It was not quite as romantic, but it was a big. And we had outside a gazebo.
Mm-hmm.
Which was our bar, you know. That was our, and we were carted back and forth on buses back and forth to work. The hospital was sort of near the airport, as I recall now. But we went back and forth on buses, and we hitchhiked. You know, mm-hmm. it was so unwar. It was so unwar, mm-hmm. except we wore fatigues. Except when we were going to the beach, when we wore bathing suits,
mm-hmm.
and I told you that. You know, we'd sit on the beach, and these little girls came with big straw packs in the backs with pineapples, and we'd buy a pineapple, and they would take a machete, and they would skin that pineapple in four pieces. Pretty soon, you've got a handle, and you've got a piece of pineapple with not a speck of skin or anything on it. I don't remember how much we paid for it. And there were times sitting on the beach where we saw Vietnamese people, guys, in funky uniforms, which I incidentally still have a pair in a trunk back at home, Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing, a souvenir, a big thing. And people would say, you know, those are VC, but this is an R&R for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know. I guess it was. I don't know. It was kind of a neutral area. We also had a lot of Australian.
Mm-hmm.
There were Australian people there. I told you about the civilian Australians that we met. And there was an Australian hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very small. There were Australian troops there. There were several different nationalities, mm-hmm. you know, around the area. Anyway, and that's the life we led from September through, and in December, we had, of course, all these married guys were just crying and all over the place, and we drank much too much because we were working a regular day. We were, you know, mm-hmm. some of the places working 12-hour day shifts. We only had to work 8-hour shifts, mm-hmm. you know. And Christmas came, and a group of us decided that we were going to have a Christmas cocktail party. And it was going to be, you know, like a 6 to 8 cocktail party. Mm-hmm. And at 8 o'clock, everyone was getting out. They were, you know, it was not going to be like everything else where people just fell all over the place and said, "Darn it." And somebody sent me a Christmas tree, a paper Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. And when we started talking about this party, people said, you know, for some reason everybody got together and said, "People keep sending me these special packages from, oh, you know, I'm trying to think of some of the name of the place, Cheeses, Harry and David's, and all this uh-huh. stuff. What am I going to do with all this?" Bring it to the party, you know, give it to us. And we are going to have a very nice, true Christmas party with Christmas songs, and uh-huh. everybody's going to look nice. You're not going to come in your muddy old boots and get drunk and lie all over the place. And no one believed it was going to happen, but we did it. Mm-hmm. We did it. We had, oh gosh, 2 or 3 of us. And we had the little Christmas tree there, and we made things out of aluminum foil. We hung it on the tree, and we had music, mm-hmm. we had Christmas music. And where did we get an electric skillet? We had an electric skillet because people had a lot of meatballs. They kept sending the meatballs. Uh-huh. So we had an electric skillet, and we had meatballs. And we took paper towels. I took paper towels and I folded them in quarters, and we found some red and green marking, and I made holly and little leaves on it. Those are our cocktail napkins. We were determined, some of us nurses were determined that we were going to have a really nice cocktail party, you know, mm-hmm. that these guys were not going to be lying around crying about not being home, blah, 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 because we were going to get them out of there before they did that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I had a nice room on the corner. Well, you know. It was about half the size of this, you know. Anyway, and we had the Christmas party. We had a Christmas cocktail party. Uh-huh. And at 8 o'clock, it was from 6 to 8. We had told people it was from 6 to 8. Mm-hmm. We started sending them away. Uh-huh. Sending them away. And we closed the door. And they were all standing out in the hall and said, "Oh, my God." So they went someplace else and had their party. Anyway, everyone talked about it, you know, that it was, we tried to make a little reality, you know, a little, oh, you know, we're here, we're not home, but there can be something nice about it. Anyway, uh-huh. but we did that. Anyway, so that was Christmas, and then, you know, New Year's, and then then comes Tet. Mm-hmm. Then comes Tet. Mm-hmm. And that's when the walls came tumbling down, when we realized that all hell was breaking loose someplace, and we weren't part of it yet, but we were becoming part of it, and that's when those Hueys started coming in, mm-hmm. and dropping people by the hundreds, some mm-hmm. hurt, some not hurt, some, oh, well, mm-hmm. and I already told you all that, but with one little girl, oh, I almost had her name, trying to run from one doctor to another, trying to interpret where mm-hmm. where their pains were, and if their wounds weren't obvious, people mm-hmm. couldn't tell. Mm-hmm. And then it got to the point where you're ripping clothes off people to see if they had, you know, if what was going on with them. And like I said, like carnation, we could tell. Mm-hmm. Yep, a bullet had gone through here and here, and she's burned all over here. Mm-hmm. And we got very organized very quickly. Very quickly we got organized. And our chief nurse realized that there was no way those Hueys were not going to come back and pick up the families and take them back to a village that had been destroyed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we had families. We had all the families. Now, then comes the problem of, and we're doing the silver nitrate dressings. Oh, mm-hmm. that was really, really hard. And then we're finding little old men, mm-hmm. little old men who are sitting there burned, 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 just smoking their pipes, happy as clams. Guess what they're smoking? They didn't need pain medicine. They had their own. They had their own. And then came how to feed them. What to do. We had American food. I mean, they were just they had food for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was decided that our commanding officer was just a really nice guy, And we decided that the ambulatory ones could go to the mess hall. Mm-hmm. They could go with us until the personnel started saying, oh, please, no. They reach with their hands, they grab the food with their hands. We can't eat behind them. We can't go in the same. So then it was decided, okay, that we would feed the whole family, everybody, in the wards. And it was a while before, I don't know how long it took before we realized that we had to get more rice. I mean, they were interested in toast and bacon and ham, you know, and that kind of stuff. So that all came about the same time that we got the sulfamylon from Burke Army Medical Center, mm-hmm. and the tanks,
mm-hmm.
so that we could soak them, mm-hmm. which was much more comfortable for them in their burns. Soak them, and then to breed them and put the sulfamylon,
mm-hmm.
and then they were much. Patients were much happier. But we got to be, as I said, we were a little Vietnamese village.
Mm-hmm.
We hardly had any GI patients. They were pretty much,
mm-hmm.
oops, there, is that where he is?
Mm-hmm.
What does he do?
He works at Ohio.
Took care of them all.
Mm-hmm. And so they had said that Phung Tao was kind of the place where civilian Vietnamese would come.
That, yeah, the army, right, sometime in the middle of all this stuff,
uh-huh.
the Army designated us as a civilian center,
uh-huh.
as a civilian center, which worked out well because we didn't know we were set up for it, but we turned out to be
uh-huh.
well set up for it.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, we had some other tragic things. I don't know how long your tape is, but you're going to enjoy this. We had a young Australian, who was a triple amputee, okay? And he came to us. He was absolutely the most handsome guy you'd ever want to meet. And he was with us for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
He was with us so long that they brought his mother from Australia in the middle of all this, his mother from Australia to see him because he had, okay, he had one leg and half a leg and an arm. You know, he's blown up.
Mm-hmm.
So we had him for a long, long time. And we got very, very, very... And the nurses who took care of him, Gert Baker, who lives here in San Antonio right now, she knows him very well, took care of him. And he always had a picture of his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Had a picture of his girlfriend. He lost his right arm. Okay, he lost his right arm. So he was with us for 2 or 3 or 4 months before they could evacuate him back to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went, I have pictures, and I was only a supervisor, and I have pictures of him going into the ambulance, and everyone was in tears when he left. But they were happy for him.
Mm-hmm.
And within a couple of months, we got letters. The girls who took care of him got letters from him. And he said, it took me a long time because I had to learn to write left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, I don't know exactly how he said it, but the girlfriend couldn't handle him. And I've gotten over that and things and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and that was sort of the end of it. And that was in the 60s, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to jump forward. And there's a group of nurses from the hospital that we're at, the evacuation hospital that we at, that has a reunion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Annie Philbin lives up in Oregon, and she sort of became kind of, and she was one of the nurses who took care of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of became very active in 36th Evac alumni kind
uh-huh.
of group. So we've had reunions,
uh-huh.
and several years, 3 or 4 or 5, the first reunion. And then she got a website,
uh-huh.
da da da, and to get all the people in, and suddenly, on her website, some Australian guy finds the website, and it's the guy
uh-huh.
that I'm telling you about, and he was coming to the States. So Annie Philbin, I live in San Francisco. So Annie came down from Oregon, and another Annie who lives in Las Vegas, Brett Baker who lives here, they all came to San Francisco, and he, his wife, and his valet, actually not his valet, a very good friend who had been in the Army with him, mm-hmm. who sort of took care of him and traveled with he and his wife, mm-hmm. and all met. Mm-hmm. They came into Los Angeles, and they almost missed the plane to L.A. because he had a prosthesis, mm-hmm. and he was just exhausted, so they finally put him in a wheelchair, and they got him up. And I tell you, these Australians are made of some kind of something. They really are. So they get to San Francisco, and the Annies are staying at my house in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and they go out to the airport, and they get them in there. And we have a night at my house that you cannot believe. Mm-hmm. This guy, he's got a prosthesis here, and he's got a prosthesis on his arm. Is that your husband? Where am I?
We were talking about the guy from Australia who came back.
Your
house.
And I have, in our house, we have four sets of stairs that come up, you know, to the front door. And the guy gets out of the taxi, and he's got a Canadian crutch on one side, and he's got no hand. And he just climbed up the stairs. He climbed up the stairs and came into the house, and we sat under the van. He threw the crutch down, and we just talked like we had, you know, like it was last week that we'd seen one another. He was marvelous, and his wife was charming, and he's very, very actively involved in the Australian veterans, especially the injured one. Uh-huh. And he knew a couple of other guys that we had taken care of. He knew uh-huh. them. And then I fixed dinner. I can't remember what we did. We all fixed dinner. We were there for hours. It was like, you know, it's like seeing something that you had started and you never thought you were ever going to see the end of. And here was this guy uh-huh. that I remember putting him into a car, you uh-huh. know, that was going to take him away forever, and here he was. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most wonderful reunions I can uh-huh. ever remember. And the guy still keeps in touch through this website. Mm-hmm. He still keeps in touch with everybody. And this group is, they're meeting back in Virginia later on uh-huh. this year. So they were, you know. There are a lot of things about the Army. Well, look at this group of women down here that you've just been seeing. Uh-huh. I mean, some of us haven't seen one another for 20 years, uh-huh. and we're still coming back just to see who looks older. That's essentially what it is. Uh-huh. Okay, anyway, back to, I'm just trying to think of some other things in Vietnam that were really cool that you...
What was it like being the senior officer in the hospital, where most of your nurses were 21, 22, 23?
Well, let me tell you, when this all happened, the first 3 months, I felt as though I was a psychiatrist. I really mm-hmm. did. I really did. Stupid things. Okay, I'll tell you one stupid incident. This was in the fall when I first got there. Across the street from our Villa Dubois was some helicopter. There was a helicopter unit, and they had about a three-level place. Mm-hmm. And I told you, that we partied a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, we took care of the patients and we partied because we were so far away from what was going on. Actually, that was before really the war got on. And they had their parties up on their roof. Mm-hmm. And there was a new young nurse had just come in. And we were all partying up on the roof. And one of the guys came and said, "Hi, Major, one of your nurses is..." I was a lieutenant colonel by then. I can't remember. Whatever it was, I was in charge. "Uh-huh. One of your nurses is over there. She's going to jump off the roof." And I said, "Oh, excuse me. She's gonna jump. Are you sure? She's probably had too much to..." "Well, yeah, she is, but she's gonna jump off the roof." Anyway, we had to be very careful. So we go, we get her, and she is drunk. Mm-hmm. She's drunk, but she's saying, "Oh, I don't want to be here. I want to be taken care of." So we take her back to the hospital, and we put her in observation, which means that she's in the recovery ward. She's mm-hmm. in a bed in the end of a recovery ward with a curtain around her, and somebody's watching her. Now, we did not have a psychiatrist where we were. Mm-hmm. The psychiatrist was in Seoul, mm-hmm. and this was the weekend, and the chief nurse was not on the weekend, so I had to take her in a helicopter up to Seoul to be interviewed by the psychiatrist. So they got one of these funky little helicopters, bubble, where they set us in here and then they pull this bubble over us.
Mm-hmm.
We are literally plastic between us and the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to tell you, by that time I was so mad at her. I was so scared of this ride and I was so mad at her.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, darling, you damn well better be sick. Because if you're not. Anyway, so they chopper us up to Seoul, uh-huh. where she's interviewed by the psychiatrist who said, there's nothing. There's no problems. Mm-hmm. Then I had to get on this same funky little airplane beside her
mm-hmm.
and fly back with this piece of plastic between me and the world. Anyway, we were not very good friends. And come Monday, I recommended to the chief nurse, I said, let her go someplace. Send her someplace. She's going to be nothing but trouble to us. And I am never going to fly with her so in that airplane again. So we tried to get her. I think we got her transferred. I'm not sure, but anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That was the worst thing. Mm-hmm. The rest of them just cried and mumbled and just wanted to be something. Mm-hmm. And really were not good nurses. They were not good nurses because they were not doing what they ought to have been doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they should have been helping these guys, except the fact that they had to go back, you know. Instead, mm-hmm. they were crying in their own beer. Not all. I'm not saying all, but mm-hmm. a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Did they kind of get over that? Was that
Then Ted came.
Uh-huh.
Then they were working their little buns off. Then they were really working. They were really working.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they weren't taking care of GIs, but they were busy working.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
mm-hmm.
some of them were still complaining that they should be taking care of GIs, but
mm-hmm.
we eliminated them.
Uh-huh.
Let them go. These uh-huh. people need it, you know. You can't discuss philosophy, you know. These people need us, but we're fighting them. We're not fighting these people, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So those kind of people don't understand that. They don't understand that. We're not fighting these people. These people aren't fighting us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we try not to keep too many shit disturbers around if we could. But we had some marvelous women, some wonderful, wonderful, caring, loving women. In fact, a few of them adopted Vietnamese kids. I mean, they were single women and they ended up adopting Vietnamese kids,
mm-hmm.
getting very involved with
mm-hmm.
it. It's, I mean, so you meet all kinds of people and all kinds of stuff goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, okay, so from Tet then until I left in September, that's what we were. We just took care of the Vietnamese, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much the Vietnamese, and that's because
uh-huh.
the Tet changed the whole aura of of what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And I came home from there in September.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And that was the end of my Vietnam.
Uh-huh. Did what other kinds of problems, or did you have other kinds of problems with morale, maybe, in the hospital?
We had a couple of kids who would just take off with some of the chopper pilots to places that they weren't supposed to go. But they were the kind of kids mm-hmm. who would have done it if they were in college in the United States, you know,
uh-huh.
and didn't care that they were in the army, that this was against the rules,
uh-huh.
and didn't, you know, they could have cared about court martial. They can't court martial
uh-huh.
me, and they never did. You know, that never happened. It was they just were disruptive. They were
uh-huh.
just a little disruptive. But generally not. I don't remember. And I don't remember that any of the enlisted personnel, any of the other medical personnel,
mm-hmm.
they just did their jobs. They just
mm-hmm.
did their jobs, did them well. And of course the doctors are happy as clams because they were just operating a gazoo, you know, they were just
mm-hmm.
taking care of things that they had never taken care of before, that they might never ever take care of again.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're not going to get many napalm burns.
Yeah,
you know, in Chicago, or well, because then we had New York, so.
Uh-huh.
But generally, it was a pretty content group of people doing
uh-huh.
doing what they came to do, and we had enough. We had a cadre of oldies, older persons, you know, or regular army people,
mm-hmm.
but at that time there were the 2-year nurses, the Army, like I said, because of Vietnam, the Army was recruiting these nurses who could go to Vietnam for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's a lot of literature out there, some of it written by some of these gals, which is their own fantasies, I think. Uh-huh. And some of it that I've read, it's their own fantasies, uh-huh, of what they thought was going to be and what it really wasn't. I mean, it was just, uh-huh, a drudge job. Come on, it's a drudge job. It wasn't, you know, uh-huh, you're not gonna get on the cover of Cosmopolitan because, you know, you're an army nurse in Vietnam. Uh-huh. Well, maybe somebody, uh-huh, did.
Do you think do you think they had maybe a misperception of what
really,
war was?
Yeah,
or?
I do. Mm-hmm. I really do. I really, really do. Uh-huh. I really think it was for some of them, it was more of a theatrical kind of, they saw themselves as, you know, Florence Nightingale or something or other, and, mm-hmm, you know, and a lot of it was what we did. I mean, that was the hard thing, like I'm saying to you, that, so we're taking care of enemies. You're here, you're a nurse. You, uh-huh, you take care of sick people. I mean, do you question? Who are you going to question? Now, if you're at Walter Reed and you're in the VIP unit, you might take care of President Eisenhower or somebody like that, but, uh-huh, but you're not. You're in Vietnam, and you're, uh-huh, taking care of some poor little kid who can't understand, yeah, you, who's, you know, who's burned from head to toe or something. Yeah. That was, you know, a lot of it was that. And I'm not saying they were all like that. You know, uh-huh, a lot of them were just really fine for them, but, uh-huh, but the few who were, you know, interestingly enough, those are the ones you kind of remember. You're like, mm-hmm, why did this happen to them? You know, why does this... Mm-hmm. Who knows? You know, you don't know anything about the background or about where they came from or what, you know, why it all happened. But most of them were baccalaureates. They were from university programs, and, mm-hmm, and then the Army. And then maybe the Army made it. They gave this big glaring thing, go to Vietnam for 2 years and, mm-hmm, save the world. Who knows? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, uh-huh, there were a lot of fine women and men. Uh-huh. Women and men.
Did you have men nurses,
yes,
in your hospital?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you even mention that? I mean, they just came and worked. Uh-huh. Why is that? I don't remember any of the young men being, you know, being disruptive. They, you know, it was just, for some reason, it just seemed to me that there was just a few of the young women who thought, mm-hmm, they should be someplace else. Mm-hmm. Now, because the men may have gotten themselves to someplace else by going through the proper channels without making a lot of noise, if that's what they wanted. If not, they just stayed where they were. They stayed in Bung Tao, and they took care of whoever they were told to take care of, and, uh-huh, went on their way. Uh-huh. They went on their way.
Were they generally older than the female?
Well,
nurses,
no, there were some of them were younger. Mm-hmm. Some of them were younger.
Did they have the same kind of assignments as the women,
uh-huh,
or did they have different?
Exactly the same assignments. Exactly, mm-hmm, the same assignments. They all had this. All had the same assignments. They were not. No, there was nothing special for any of them. Uh-huh. For any of them.
And did they hang out with the women nurses then?
Uh-huh. Well, we all lived together in this, uh-huh, you know, in this Villa de Bois, and our whole social life was in this, you know, it was in this place, and, uh-huh, and everybody got along. Everyone got it very long. Because, you know, the other thing we had there too were doctors who had been called in for 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know how they do. You know, when, in a crisis, some of these guys. And we had some marvelous doctors who were there for 2 years. And, uh-huh, but for some reason, they were, as long as they were doing what they wanted to do, and they were. Uh-huh. You know, they were practicing medicine. What they were. Uh-huh. But we all lived, you know, we all lived in the same thing. The second lieutenants and the first lieutenants and the happy ones and the unhappy ones and the doctors and everybody, uh-huh, lived in the same place. Uh-huh. And we couldn't get away from one another. We lived together, we ate together, we worked, uh-huh, together, we went to, yeah, the beach together. There was not much, you know, there was no way to get away, to, uh-huh, get away from each other. But there didn't seem to be, no, there didn't seem to be much problem with it. You know, I'm telling you specific things, mm-hmm, that were in my experience, which may not be that much of a problem. They may not be, you know, it may not be that, you know, that much of a problem. But at the time, I guess it was to me, because I never thought that I was going to have to sit some kid down and say, you are a nurse. Mm-hmm. You know, wherever you are a nurse. Mm-hmm. And I took care of kids. I had a lot of friends. Betty had a lot of friends who were psych nurses, psychiatric nurses. And suddenly I find myself trying to explain to this kid, mm-hmm. who was a kid. Mm-hmm. Come on, they were just kids. That she could do as much good for some guy, like I said, you know, who only had a little injury. She could do more good for him. And some guy who lost his leg, she could put a, you know, okay, so you put a, what do you call it, on and send him home, you know? Mm-hmm. But this guy needed them more. And some of them understood it. Some of them finally got it and mm-hmm. realized that. And they were good. They were good. Mm-hmm. They were good.
What kinds of things did they do?
Just talk to them. Just listen to them. Uh-huh. Just listen to them. And just, they're the same age. They were the same age. Just say how scared, you could understand how scared they were. Mm-hmm. How scared they were. They were going back to something that they'd already, and some of them could really relate, could begin to relate to someone their own age. Mm-hmm. Who wished the hell that his arm had been blown off instead of just a little thing going through. Mm-hmm. And others of them couldn't. But you know people, you know, there are some people who just are never going to get it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in that situation, you just kind of wished all of them could, but mm-hmm. all of them could. But that was, you know, that was the thing there where we were. And we all knew. Now they knew that. They didn't know that I was happy to be there because I didn't want to be someplace where people were getting their heads blown off. But you know, we all tried. Now Connie left, and where did Connie go? Connie would you know, I think Connie would agree with me that we spent as much time counseling the nurses about their responsibility to these guys as we did to anything, you know, mm-hmm. did about anything, mm-hmm. you know. And like, you know, you could say to them, hey, this guy's got malaria. You know, he may never be well. He may never. This may be something that's going to destroy part of his body, you know, forever. Just because he's here, he got this malaria, you know. Mm-hmm. He's eventually going to go home, but he's always going to have the scars from this malaria. Mm-hmm. We did, Connie and I did a lot of that kind of counseling with these kids. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Huh. Did you ever experience or see it happen to anyone around you, some kind of sexual harassment? Or maybe you feel different because you were, you know, there were fewer women in Vietnam. Did you maybe?
You know, I have to say no. Mm-hmm. I have to say no. Never, ever, never, ever, ever felt that. Mm-hmm. No, the people I worked with who were on a level with me, male and female, and we had a commanding officer who was a male, of course, who was a magnificent gentleman, and the people who worked with him, no, never felt any kind of sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. There may have been some sexual stuff going on, but it was. They agreed to it. What am I trying to say?
Consensual.
You know, I mean, any of that stuff. No, never, ever, never, ever in Vietnam felt any kind of. Uh-huh. Never, never. Uh-huh. Never did.
And you guys wore fatigues?
We wore fatigues.
Was that an issue? Did people talk about wearing fatigues or wearing whites or?
Nope. No, we knew. No.
What do you think that would have been protests maybe if you had been told you have to wear whites?
You know, I think maybe in Seoul with the big hospital, I think they did wear whites. I'm not sure. I think they might have before the Tet thing. I think they might have. Mm-hmm. We have no laundry facilities. Mm-hmm. The Vietnamese women washed our clothes on stones, you know, uh-huh. down there, and dried them in the open air. And I'll tell you something. When I came home from Vietnam, I came into Travis, and my sister and brother-in-law and her four kids lived in Nevada, in mm-hmm. California, and they came up and picked me up. And I came in fatigues, of course, you know, and we drove from Travis, which is probably an hour and a half down to Nevada. And the next day, we got up, and my sister said, why don't we do some laundry? And I kept saying, I said to her, oh no, Mama-san, my clothes are all clean. Mama-san did my laundry. And then we went to, I must have come on Saturday, because then we went to church. My sister was ironing. I had one civilian thing that I took with me and came back to go to church. And she, for some reason, she kept saying, well, when we get back from church, we'll do your laundry. And I kept insisting that Mama-san had, my clothes were clean. It was about 3 days, Carol, because before I opened the suitcase, everything I had was so mildew. And I didn't even know it. We all smelled the same, you know, so we didn't even know it. Until 3 days, and my sister said, oh, thank God, I didn't want to tell you, but the kids were beginning to say about it. Anya, it smells funny. Anyway, and we walked into Esther, but we couldn't have worn whites. We couldn't possibly have worn. But, you know, that same mildew thing, the first couple of days you're there, I remember they took me to a great restaurant, a great Vietnamese French restaurant, and this was like in September before the you know, and I went down and we walked up these stairs and the odor was just so, I said, okay, I'll stay, you know, I'm going to stay, but I'm really not hungry. Mm-hmm. And I watched these people eating this. I couldn't stand the smell of what they were eating. They're eating this soup and eating this bread. I told you the bread, they had a little black specks in it. Mm-hmm. And within 2 weeks, I'm dragging someone up those stairs and saying, hey, this is, it's amazing how you can acclimate yourself to what's there. And we ate everything we saw, including we take the little black pieces out of the bread. I talked about this wonderful French bread that we're eating. And in fact, it was just a couple of weeks ago, I was with my sister and we were talking about it, and she said, oh my God, I thought, I didn't know how long you were going to stay there smelling your clothes, smelling like they did without until you realized it. It was about 3 days before I realized everything I had smelled was mildew. But, you know, but of course it was so, you know, it was so humid there, and they just, our things, they never dried, nothing dried, you know, nothing actually dried. And we didn't, neither did we, but we got used to it, didn't matter. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
How did Vietnam compare to Korea?
Oh.
How were those two experiences, similar or different?
Okay, we lived in Quonset huts. Our hospital were Quonset huts. In Korea, we took care of a lot of civilians because we didn't have that many. The wounded were accidents. You know, there was no war going on. And so we took care of many more civilians. Mm-hmm. And the doctors in Korea were looking for special things. I mean, they were, you know, like I said, they were taking care of tuberculosis of the bone. That's what we saw, you know, and that they had, you're never going to see any of it. Lots of different kinds of things. And the neurosurgeons were taking worms out of people's brains. I mean, they were doing all that kind of stuff. And but the life was pretty similar. We were in a compound. Mm-hmm.